The Sisters of the Islamic Center of Bloomington invite you to explore hijab from a personal perspective. We want to share the importance of hijab, why we choose to wear it, and what it means to us, in the hopes that by listening to our stories, you will come to better understand who we are as Muslims, women, and humans. The Hijabi Diaries. Muslim women speaking for themselves.
Hello, my name is Aubrey Cedar, and you're listening to The Hijabi Diaries. It's been a long time since our last episode, and during that time, some things have happened.
This is a Fox News election alert. Pennsylvania goes to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the president of the United States.
Nearly every woman that I've spoken to during the process of making The Hijabi Diaries has made a comment on how important the outcome of the 2016 presidential election would be to them and to the future of their families if they plan to continue to live in America. Much also hung in the balance for refugees who were attempting to make their way to the U.S. from war-torn and Muslim-majority nations. I caught up with a friend and a Hijabi Diaries participant, Abby, just before the new year to talk about how she was feeling about the results of the election.
I'm Abby, Bloomington Muslim, mother extraordinaire, cat and dog lover.
Abby invited me over to her house to talk.
I don't know.
Her house is a part of a small neighborhood on the southwest side of Bloomington, just outside the city limits. It's a rural neighborhood. Her house has plenty of backyard. The kids are at school, and the only company that we keep are the two fat, long-haired cats sitting on the couches across from us. Abby is wearing her characteristic purple horn-rimmed glasses and her bubbly smile. But since we're in her home, she isn't wearing her hijab. It always takes me a moment to adjust to seeing my hijab-wearing friends without their hijabs. And after I do adjust, I feel strangely flattered, or I guess touched, that they are willing not just to host me in their home, but also to allow me to glimpse perhaps a more vulnerable side of them that few other people get to see.
I'm not one of those people that's like, oh my God, my age.
Like, your age is your wisdom.
Yeah, like, what do I have to be ashamed of? I have been alive that long. So.
Abby and I chat for a moment, and then I ask her the obvious question. How is she feeling now that the election is over?
Did you stay up to watch the election coverage?
I did. I just sat there on my phone and I just like refreshed. I watched, you know, the states go from blue to red and back to blue again. And I was like feverishly texting my friend at like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning being like, oh dear God.
Were you by yourself or with your husband?
I mean, my husband finally, he said, I can't watch this anymore. He's won. And he just went to bed. And I was just laying there. Being like, oh my God, he's winning. This is the worst thing ever.
I just want to point out here that since we'll be talking about the election in this episode, although we at the Hijabi Diaries are passionate about sharing the opinions and stories of the women that we interview, the partisan political beliefs that they may share during their interviews do not represent the political beliefs of the show, of our producers, or of the Open Hearted campaign. The day of the election, Abby had an experience with a neighbor that started to make her question her safety. She lives in a neighborhood where her family is the only Muslim family, and she says that during the 8 years they lived in the neighborhood, they've only been able to make friends with a handful of families. But because of her hijab and her modest dress, people always recognize her when she's out mowing the grass, letting the cats out, or just hanging out on her porch.
So I know that people see me and recognize me as, like, the Muslim element in the neighborhood, but on that Tuesday that, you know, it was getting around like time for my husband to come home, and my daughter suddenly was like, I want to let the cat outside. And she flung open the front door, and I was standing there, and as she flung open the door, this man was driving by our house really, really slowly, and he had his entire body turned towards our house. You know, it wasn't like he was looking for an address or anything. I mean, I guess it could have been, but he had his entire body just turned towards our house. And he was just glaring at our front door. And it was just by chance that I opened up the door at that time and saw him. And it seemed very threatening to me. Since the election, I've had friends harassed and names screamed at them. You know, of course, you see things on the news and women are just walking down the street and people just attack them. There was a girl like pushed down the stairs in the subway. So this is concerning for me. I went so far as I got my gun license, so I have the legal right to carry a handgun.
I wanted to know more about what made Abby believe that she needed to carry a gun. I've known Abby for over a year now, and I know that there was no way that she'd make this decision lightly.
I had actually started to fill out my application for it before the election, and I was like, you're being crazy. And then after the election and all of these like hate crimes and mosques are being burned, I'm like, you know, I've gotten to the point where it's like I'm nervous when I'm in the mosque and I suddenly hear like loud talking from someone, you know, because I'm like, is that somebody breaking in here to like mow us all down?
There have been multiple incidents of mosques being attacked by gunmen, being vandalized, or being burned in America in the years since 9/11. On January 30th of this year, a Canadian gunman in Quebec City entered a mosque during prayers and open-fired, killing six brothers and seriously injuring eight others. A report published by the Southern Poverty Law Center shows that there was a sudden rise in hate crimes committed throughout the U.S. during the first 10 days after the presidential election. Abby believes that this rise in hate crimes has to do with the election of President Donald Trump, who has made derogatory statements about multiple ethnic and racial groups throughout his campaign. Abby believes that many people with racist or xenophobic beliefs were emboldened by his election to the presidency, and that this emboldening led them to commit acts of terror and violence. She worries that there will be more, and closer to home.
I just keep imagining, like, I'm going to be out with my kids somewhere, and somebody's going to try and make a scene or make me feel like I don't belong in a more aggressive way than just staring. And I'm not going to be prepared. And at this point, I'm like, I'm going to be prepared.
You might be seeing safety pins on people's lapels and shirts more than you used to, which is probably not at all.
After the election, something called the safety pin campaign began. People across the United States started wearing safety pins on their clothing every day to announce to their friends, neighbors, and to complete strangers that they were a safe person to come to for support should any person that they pass find themselves being harassed or even just glared at like Abby was. Thousands of people around the country wear these safety pins, and their message seems to be uplifting for many who are otherwise scared or stressed out by world events these days. However, what does it take to actually stick up for your neighbor in situations of injustice, when there is aggression, harsh words, maybe even violence? To find out, I went to talk to someone who has a lot of experience teaching people about bystander intervention.
Just tell me your name and what you do in Illinois.
I'm Evelyn Smith. I'm Prevention Programs Coordinator. So I do a lot of work teaching people the skills they need to intervene when they see violence to keep it from happening or happening again, as well as do like a lot of structural work. So like how do organizations make policies that prevent sexual violence? Mm-hmm. Bystander intervention is what we refer to sort of generally when people overcome the quote-unquote bystander effect, which is this idea that when multiple people see a bad thing happening, none of them are likely to get involved. It's called diffusion of responsibility. Everybody thinks somebody else will, or it's somebody else's job. The bystander effect in particular is pretty well studied, and that diffusion of responsibility term comes from studies. Like, people identify lots of reasons, but there are a couple of fairly common reasons they identify they don't get involved. So they think it's somebody else's responsibility. Even if they don't think it's somebody else's responsibility, they think somebody else will do it. Often, like, they are legitimately afraid when you see, especially when we see violence happening, we're afraid that's going to target us, right. Even if that's relatively unlikely in a crowd.
Mm-hmm. And how do you teach people? Like, what's the process of teaching people to be go from bystanders to leaders? Interveners, I guess you could call them.
Right. Some people say upstanders. It's a fairly common one. So in general, like, we usually just ask people, like, do you feel like you should get involved when you see something bad happening? Almost everybody says yes, right? People agree that, like, when bad things happen, it is the responsibility of the community in general to step in and prevent them from happening or to manage, like, the negative effects of them having happened. People agree that that's a community responsibility. So the question isn't necessarily about, like, convincing people that they need to. It's giving them the skills that they need to. And so, like, I like to do, like, a five-step process. Identify that something bad is happening, where we talk to people about, like, how do you notice when something is unacceptable. So we talk a lot about sexual violence. We talk about with people, what does it look like when consent is not being practiced? So, like, what kind of body language is common, what kind of scenarios are really common. Second step is assess the situation. So figure out if it's safe to get involved. And if not, like what might be some alternatives. So the third step is coming up with a specific strategy, how you actually want to engage and step in and interrupt the situation. There are a couple of different strategies. So we talk about the three Ds, direct action, delegation, and distraction.
I asked Evelyn to explain the three Ds a little more for me.
So we talk about direct action is often the simplest. The example we tend to give, especially when we're working in schools, is if you see a bully harassing your friend, you step in and tell the bully, hey, that's not okay. You get in between them, you're inserting yourself directly in the situation. So delegation is getting somebody else involved, and that can be a group of people, it can be a single person. Often, like the three common like people that we say you might get involved are friends of the person who's being targeted, friends of the person who is targeting them, because that's actually, there's a lot of social pressure you can put there, and then an authority figure. And the last one, distraction. We've talked about changing the situation. So that might be making a loud noise, drawing attention to you, bumping into the situation. We often talk about like spilling drinks on people is a common intervention tactic in parties when you see somebody like is creeping on someone, got them cornered or something.
Spilling.
Cup of water, usually free. All over them. It'll diffuse the situation, right? So you're not necessarily like getting involved yourself directly. You're not confronting the situation. You're not necessarily getting anybody else involved. You're just doing something weird.
Being taught these tools made me feel a little more empowered. Having a bag of tricks for these scenarios made me feel a lot less helpless. And then I thought about the times that I'd stood up for people without knowing how, just by throwing myself in the middle of something so it would stop. Daniel Boyes is a man who threw himself in the middle of something that I think all of us hope we'll never have to see.
I'm Daniel Boyes. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, originally. I go to school here at IU in Bloomington. 22 years old now. When the incident happened, I was 21.
The incident that Daniel is referring to is an assault that he stopped in the fall of 2015.
That day it was homecoming. I remember that. So, you know, the whole city's like really crowded. There's a lot of people there, more than normal. But my friend was actually, she was in an Irish like dance group, and they were doing something at a local pub or bar. So I was going to go see them and meet some other friends there to see her. We were just walking down. I was just walking down by myself to go to the bar, and I just hear somebody, you know, screaming things. And you don't normally see somebody just like screaming, you know, racist things, or you know, if somebody is like a, you know, racist or has something like that, they usually keep that to themselves, or you know, he's screaming at the top of his lungs. If I just see him, you know, I keep my eye on him because it was just weird. And then I see him walk towards the lady and her daughter, and so I'm just thinking, you know, he could do something. So I just keep like, I just kind of like stand there and look at him, and he just starts attacking. So I run over there. Oh, he was like wrapped. He had his hands like wrapped around her like neck and head, and was like trying to pull the scarf off. And he started like hitting her head against like the table that they were sitting at. So I just ran over there, and I think I just pulled him off like with his. I think I pulled his shoulders off, and he just kind of slipped off of her. The woman's husband came outside and also like started. Once he was on the ground, he came over and you know put his weight on him and stopped him until the police came.
Obviously, in this case, Daniel chose to intervene with direct action. Other reports of the incident say that the actions of the attacker made the woman and those around her fear for her life. It wasn't a situation in which there was time to strategize, delegate, or distract. And what about the fallout? Did Daniel get time to talk to the woman he stood up for, whose life he saved after the incident was over? Evelyn Smith.
Dramatic events always have fallout, and it's important that that's like proactively managed.
Did you see the woman's reaction when you pulled him off of her?
Yeah, she was like, she looks very, very distraught, and she looked very scared, and she went inside to her restaurant where she was outside of, and I, you know, she was, you know, very, pretty hysterical, and she had her husband come out and take care of him.
The woman that Daniel saved, her name is Nadja. They're friends now, and they see each other every once in a while. After the incident, Nadja asked Daniel if she could meet his parents. They did meet, but Daniel isn't sure what was said during the meal that they shared together. I asked Daniel if he knew any Muslim people or had any preconceived notions of Muslim culture or religion before getting to know Nadja. He said he'd grown up with a number of Muslim friends. They played basketball at the local mosque together, and he learned a lot about their cultures and ate amazing food. I asked Daniel if he was scared at all when he saw Nadja being attacked.
Not really. I would say I was scared. I was just like, I don't know. I wasn't really scared. I don't really know what I was saying. I was just trying to stop him.
Do you think that, like, if you had the opportunity to do something like that again, you would do it? If you saw someone else being hurt in that way, that you would take action again the way you did that day?
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't. Yeah. I wouldn't hesitate.
Do you think you're less afraid now that you've done it once? You're like, I got this, guys.
I mean, maybe, but I don't know. Not really. Because I don't know. Every situation's different and everything. So the person could be, you know, right. I don't know, state champion wrestling, or they could have a weapon or something.
Evelyn Smith.
Like, there are legitimate dangers associated with intervening in situations, particularly, like, if somebody's violent. Mm-hmm. It is legit to be scared. Like, that's a reasonable assessment of the situation. Mm-hmm. So often when that happens, like, we talk with them, like, specifically, what are you afraid of? And then how can you troubleshoot that with these different answers? Mm-hmm. So if it's fear, for example, of physical violence, mm-hmm. getting a group of people can be, like, a good way to deter that, because like, somebody being physically violent is unlikely to attack a group of people, and if they do, it's probably fairly easy to subdue that person. But if it's, like, social violence, for example, talk about, like, things without social consequences. Mm-hmm. So, like, things that are just weird or strange. So, like, at a party, you can turn on the lights, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to know it's you. Right. At the extreme end, you can pull a fire alarm. I wouldn't recommend that unless it's a pretty bad situation, but it's an option, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, like, people bring those up, and those are legitimate concerns. Like, I'm not going to pretend that it's easy to intervene, mm-hmm. But there are ways, like, to strategize around it.
That day on the street, Daniel told me that many people were out walking, and some of them saw what happened. Perhaps if he hadn't felt comfortable approaching the situation alone, he could have asked for help from passersby. It's been over a year since the violent incident outside Sofer Cafe made headlines all over the state of Indiana. Up until mid-January, Nadja, her family, and Daniel waited patiently to hear what would become of Nadja's attacker, a former IU student named Tristan Bickford. Daniel surprised me by saying that although he had gotten 5 invitations in the mail to testify in court and could have perhaps been a key witness for the prosecution, he chose not to give his testimony or to attend the hearings.
I've been getting, like, court things where I could go to court and see his court dates and stuff like
that.
No, I've never really had an interest to.
No. They're not called as a witness.
I'm not being called as a witness. They said I could testify if I wanted to, but I just think, you know, he's going to do what he wants to do. I don't want to, like, help to ruin anybody's life, really.
Right, so you feel like if you went in and testified that you would be, like, aiding in ruining his life?
Yeah, something like that. I don't want to make any trouble.
Just days after my interview with Daniel, the headlines came out announcing that Tristan Bickford's last hearing and sentencing had happened. After being charged with multiple felonies, undergoing an FBI investigation into whether or not the crime was hate-motivated, 5 of the 6 charges against Tristan Bickford were dropped, and he was charged with misdemeanor battery and sentenced to a year of parole with no jail time. Just like ordinary citizens play a big role in setting norms in their communities, members of the state and federal governments, like police officers, judges, or elected officials, can do a lot through their work to set norms for a city, a state, or for the entire nation. State Senator Greg Taylor of Indiana's 33rd District in Indianapolis attended the sentencing and hearing for Tristan Bickford and was outraged by the result. To him, a year of parole with no jail time was nowhere near enough penance for a crime that was obviously bias-motivated. Hello?
Hello, Aubrey Cedar, please?
Yes, this is Aubrey Cedar. Is this Brett Stinson?
This is Senator Taylor.
Hi, Senator Taylor. Oh, I didn't know it was you. It's nice to meet you over the phone.
Nice to meet you over the phone, too.
Oh, cool. Senator Taylor has been working for the past 6 years to get 2 crime bills through the Indiana State Legislature. Indiana is one of only 5 states in the entire country that has not yet established laws that address bias-motivated crimes, or as they are better known, hate crimes. And so my question is, like, what's the holdup? Like, why do you think we haven't passed this legislation before? Like, what are the obstacles that have come up?
Well, one of the things that I see here in Indiana that's consistent across the board is that we tend to be more conservative in our thinking. We don't really prescribe to the more liberal thought when it comes to legislation. We want to be very careful, and we don't want things to change. Change is scary in Indiana, and I think that leads to a lot of decisions that maybe aren't thought out as well as they should be. And I think that's what's happened in the state of Indiana over all these years, that people don't want change. In addition to that, I think people misunderstand the law. Even as we spoke here, believe it or not, there are people who believe this doesn't protect white people. And that's absurd. It does. It protects everybody. Well, every group is part of it. And I say that sincerely, not just as a speaking point. It doesn't say if you're somebody attacks you because you're brown skin, yellow skin, or white skin. It doesn't say if you're Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. It doesn't say if you're a man or a woman. It says race, religion, and gender. Those protect everybody. I don't even know if you have an excluded class in that group that's protected.
Senator Taylor expressed his frustration and his sadness over the sentencing that he had just attended for Tristan Bickford, Nadja's attacker.
We have people going to prison for possession of narcotics. We have people going to prison for expressing themselves in a manner that's rude or insolent. We have someone who attacked somebody, choked her, and at the same time was yelling epithets that nobody wants to hear, white power. Mm-hmm. And he gets a year probation?
Yeah.
Travesty. It's a travesty to her family. You know, when I think about this sentence, I want you to think about this, and this is what I say to everybody. How long before people start getting fed up with stuff like this? How long is it going to be before somebody who's in the someone of the Muslim persuasion says, you know what, I'm tired of, you know, I thought the justice system was to protect me too. I'm here legally. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Someone comes and attacks my wife, and he gets a year probation. Do you know? I mean, what do you do in that situation?
Right. And so my question about the case is that had your bias crime legislation been law at the time of this trial and the sentencing, walk me through how it would have gone differently. How would he have been sentenced differently?
Okay, so under he was charged with battery, I would assume. I don't know what he was charged with, but I think it was misdemeanor battery.
Yeah.
Misdemeanor assault. And that carries an A misdemeanor. That's an A misdemeanor. In Indiana, I think you can get up to a year in jail for a misdemeanor. So what my bill would do, well, there's two bills that I have. One bill would allow the court to aggravate the sentence up to the maximum amount of time that's available under that charge. So it would be able, the judge would be able to sentence him up to a year in jail. My second and the most, what I really want to pass is called an enhancement. And what that does is once the court proves, or if you claim that the charge is, you know, that the bodily injury is based on somebody's race, religion, or the protected class, then it moves it to the next level up, which is a level 6, which then carries a sentence of up, I think it's a year to 2.5 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So my sentence would have at least put this guy in jail, or at least if the judge hadn't suspended it, put him in jail for at least a year, up to 2.5 years, because mm-hmm. it would have enhanced the penalty. This is what the current bill says that they want to pass. It says if someone decides that they want to come to your house, a family of color, and burn a cross in your front yard. Hear what I'm saying now. The underlying penalty is trespass and destruction of property. Mm-hmm. Now, they may have to pay some restitution, maybe to replace your grass if it gets burned out or anything, but do you know that the most that they could get is 3 months in jail? So this bill would say the maximum time you get for burning a cross in somebody's yard is 3 months. What message does that send? This should have been a slam dunk piece of legislation. I mean, we have enhancements throughout our Indiana code. We enhance penalties based on age, based on circumstance, based on what weapon you use. We do all this stuff that sends a message. If you have a gun and you commit a robbery, you get a higher sentence than if you just commit a robbery with a knife. Well, excuse me, with your hands. But we can't enhance a penalty because you do it based on somebody's race.
Senator Greg Taylor is a great example, just as Daniel Boies is, of an upstander. He's harnessed his strength as a legislator, as an elected official. If his bill is passed, it will set a new norm not just for his constituents, but for the entire state. For more information on Senator Taylor's bills, please visit our website. I asked Daniel Boies how he felt about Tristan Bickford's sentencing. We didn't have time to get together and talk, but he did send me this message. He says, "I did hear about it, and I have mixed feelings about the situation. I believe that it is pretty serious what he did, and he should suffer consequences more severe than a year on probation. I think his actions were of a malicious intent, and he should be punished for what he did. On the other hand, he may have learned a lesson, or he may have mental issues or something else that could have influenced his actions. I think whatever punishment he would have received would have been scrutinized by many, so I am unsure how to feel about it myself." During our conversation, Abby told me that she doesn't recognize herself sometimes these days. Carrying around a gun for protection, she feels like she is both in danger and dangerous to the people around her. But she doesn't see any other way to ensure that her and her children will be protected from harassment and violence that she sees as inevitable under the current presidency. She's still searching for a gun safety program that will provide her with all the training she needs to safely carry her weapon. Many people in Bloomington have shared with me the opinion that if friends and neighbors are being threatened, being harassed, being attacked, they feel that it is their duty to help them, to protect them in some way. However, many people have also shared with me that they have absolutely no idea how to effectively protect these people. Perhaps by utilizing the tools that Evelyn teaches, leveraging what power they have the way that Senator Taylor does, or just being inspired to take action by Daniel's story, those who wish to become upstanders can make the mark that they are hoping to make. Thank you for listening to The Hijabi Diaries. I'm Aubrey Cedar. My co-producer is Anna Mighty. Special thanks to WFHB, the Islamic Center of Bloomington, Brett Stinson, State Senator Greg Taylor, Evelyn Smith, Daniel Boies. Thanks to Abby for sharing her thoughts. Among the music you heard on the podcast today are the artists Baraka Blue and Pearls of Islam. We invite you to check out their music online on our website. Hijabi Diaries is produced by the Open-Hearted Campaign to End Islamophobia in Bloomington. Visit us at www.openheartedcampaign.org. May your day be filled with love and light. May your wrongs be right. May your songs be tight. May your words give sight. May your newer shine bright. May you always be on the righteous side of the fight. May your lovers be loyal. May your soil be fertile. May your khaki stay creased. May your locks stay oil. May your plans never get foiled. May your plot thicken. May your chicken be halal. May your style be sufficient. May your soul be free of its prison.